if we bring children into this world, we have not just a moral obligation to provide for them, but a legal one. The obligation isn't quite so clear-cut when the people who brought us into the world need help in their final years, although some 40 million Americans currently care for older relatives. But unlike preparing for college, which many families regularly discuss, the transition to needing help after decades of independence is something many families avoid even thinking about, let alone planning for. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sadly, failing to acknowledge aging as a fact of life does not have the magical power to make us or our loved ones self-sufficient forever. Some older folks are really lucky in this regard, but the majority of us will need some care toward the end of life. But as my guest points out in her new book, our ageist attitudes toward getting old have kept us from preparing adequately for the aging of our society. M.T. Connolly was founding head of the Department of Justice's Elder Justice Initiative, the architect of the Elder Justice Act, and a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. Her book is called The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. M.T., welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
We collectively fail to plan sufficiently for everything we or our loved ones might need as we get into final years, but there is a huge cost to this, right? Just the care provided by family members is worth something like $500 billion a year, and that's apart from any paid care services we might use.
That's exactly right, and it's not only valued at $500 billion, but it also results in an estimated $500 billion in loss income for those caregivers, as well as lots of health issues and earlier deaths sometimes as well. So there's a high price to the care that we're not really measuring.
When you were working on elder issues at the Department of Justice, you found yourself repeatedly asking this enormous question, which is, what makes aging so much harder than it should be? And I gather you were not talking about the ways bodies and brains, you know, experience declining capacity toward the end of life. You're talking about the systems we have built around aging.
That's exactly right. We moved heaven and earth to get older and to extend our lives. And that's a really great thing, by and large. But we have not done very well to prepare for that old age, as you said in your introduction. And one aspect of this is that our health spans are not as long as our lifespan, so that the average age or the average lifespan of an American is about 78 years, whereas the average healthy lifespan is about 66 years. And about 3/4 of older people have some sort of functional disability. That means a ton more people need care, but we don't have the systems in place, and really, it's a pretty invisible need in terms of the way that we do our math and shape our policy. We haven't paid very much attention to the needs of those more than 40 million caregivers.
One driving factor you identify is ageism. How is this so rampant, given that under the best of circumstances, we will all be elderly someday?
It's such a great question, and it was really something that came as not so much a revelation in itself, but a revelation in terms of how it really undermines our ability to live well in old age. So if we just think about how we feel about aging, a lot of people, you know, a lot of us, I don't need to say them for this, a lot of us feel a combination of fear and shame and denial. And those negative feelings end up seeping into the culture so that we actually feel like it's okay to feel ageist, because as you implied, it's just our future selves that we're feeling that bias about. But there's a real toll. There's research suggesting that the people who hold the least ageist views live about 7.5 years longer than people who hold the most ageist views. So there's a toll on, you know, on our health as well as on our mental health. And it also seeps into our institutions, I believe. You know, there's a reason that we don't prepare better for aging. And part of that is the ageism, and part of it is that we're really loath to even think about it.
So when you know that our culture is obsessed with independence, it's a problem because we all function better at every age if we lead interdependent lives. What does interdependence look like if it's working properly?
I love that. I actually have come to think of the book as a declaration of interdependence because independence is really, I mean, it's a lovely thing to aspire to, and we're obsessed with it as part of our culture. But in fact, we're always interdependent with other people in our lives, whether it be our families or our friends or our communities. And, you know, in differing ways through life, we're interdependent, and sometimes we're flat out dependent. But to pretend like we're not interdependent means that we don't think about how we're bound together and how to make that interdependence a healthy one and one that we want to achieve. And so instead, we hold on to this notion of we're going to do it all ourselves. My son, when he was very young, used to say, "I'm gonna do it myself." And in fact, you know, all of us need other people and benefit from having other people in our lives.
So this 40 million odd unpaid caregivers taking care of elderly folks in this country overwhelmingly identify as women. There's no particular reason based on natural affinity or ability that this should be the case. Why is there such a disparity?
Well, they're pretty well-worn patterns in terms of gender. Those are starting to change. About 40% of caregivers are men. But I think it's part of the cultural expectation of women that we be the caregivers. And often we take it on ourselves, too, and to have a different kind of relationship with care sometimes.
In families where there are multiple people who could be providing this care, you think the country could use an army of what you call family caregiving navigators. If this existed as a profession, what could these folks help with?
For one thing, I think like older people, caregivers often end up very much alone and sometimes quite lonely in that role. And caregiving should be a team sport. And so navigators could help us literally navigate some of the challenges, which are many. You know, there are a good number of resources in our communities, but trying to find them is really hard. And so then we go back to the isolation of care because we don't have the same kind of social support. People aren't hanging out on, you know, in the bleachers watching, you know, Little League games or at recitals or whatever else. And also sharing information and tips about, you know, what's a good pediatrician or where did you find such and such. A lot of caregiving is much more solitary and to the detriment, I think, of both caregivers and the people who they're caring for. You know, there are complicated questions in terms of where to get care and what are the options and how to pay for it. They're complicated questions in terms of how to manage money, what do scams look like, and even what kinds of meanings does money take on in our lives? It can take on all sorts of symbolic value from a way to hold a grudge to a way to show love and a way to leave a legacy. And then there are these really complicated decisions relating to autonomy and safety that I think we really underestimate. You know, as adults, we have the right to make decisions about our own lives without the judgment of other people about whether those are good decisions, bad decisions, whatever, mixed decisions. But sometimes as we age, especially in the face of cognitive impairment, some of those decisions, you know, can lead to much higher risk or even harm. And so another thing that caregivers need much more guidance with is how to navigate those decisions and when is there a duty to intervene and when is there a duty to step back and say you have a right to make decisions on your own behalf, even though that might lead to more risk.
Talk a little bit about the ability that people have to manage money. There are times when dealing with one's own finances might become a problem, even though somebody is still pretty capable of living independently, you know, cooking for themselves, kind of doing the day-to-day business of everyday life. What do we do in those situations?
It's a really important question. And in the aging field, it's referred to as financial capacity. And that can begin to decline even before and sometimes in the absence of any other signs of decision-making issues. So I think this is an area where we haven't paid enough attention as a society and where some better conversations in families could really help. There are some tools to protect ourselves. So for example, you can ask to have a trusted contact included on accounts so that if a person at a financial institution, a bank or a brokerage firm or something, notices that suddenly huge amounts of money are leaving the account or there's some really unusual activity, there's somebody that they can call with an SOS. There are also, from a societal perspective, the beginnings of some protections that financial institutions are putting into place, like a temporary hold if they see some sort of unusual activity and the ability to investigate and or make a report. But, you know, one of the things that we've relied on a lot is to say, oh, look out for this kind of scam or that kind of scam. You know, there are people, there are imposters who impersonate IRS agents or Social Security or whatever and say, oh, this terrible thing's going to happen if you don't send us a lot of money. The problem is that sometimes just raising people's awareness is not going to help them that much. So we need to have protections that are preventive and that focus further upstream as opposed to just on telling consumers to protect themselves. That can help, but it's not enough.
What's in the Senior Safe Act that might help with this?
The Senior Safe Act, which was enacted by Congress in 2018, allows banks to, if the employees are trained, then they can make a report without any concern about violating Privacy Act, because there are all sorts of banking privacy acts. And so there was some confusion around that, and that got muddled. And so that made it really clear that financial institutions don't violate the Privacy Act if they make a report, provided that their employees are trained in what are suspicious kinds of circumstances.
So in other words, they would make a report. You described this before. Suddenly there's huge amounts of money moving around or leaving an account in patterns that don't reflect the way someone was managing their money previously.
That's right. And then, you know, it is really a federal-state partnership, because the state securities administrators also drafted a model law that the regulator for brokers have made mandatory that allow also, in addition to the reporting, temporary holds and trusted contacts. So it is a state-federal partnership and also a private public one, because you also need the public institutions and the private institutions to work together to protect consumers. I think much better than we're doing now. And we know that the problem is growing with the rise of the aging population, with the increased numbers of people who are going to be experiencing cognitive impairment. We really need to get our act together on this.
I think a lot of people feel a sense of obligation to care for aging parents, but legally, this is much more a gray area, right, than the obligation parents have to care for dependent children. What does the law say about who's responsible to step in when an elderly person needs help?
It's a great question without clear answer in some places. This is a matter that differs from state to state. One kind of state law would require somebody who stepped into the caregiving role to provide adequate care, so that if they did that, if they step into it and then neglect an older person, then they could be legally accountable for that. But the law is all over the place in terms of that aspect of caregiving and many others in terms of what are the obligations, how responsible are you for what, including the financial aspects of caregiving. And lots of families are struggling with that too.
I mean, families lucky enough to have the resources to supplement the care they provide with paid help often find themselves searching during a crisis, right? Someone's had a fall, or it's become clear that a person can't live independently anymore. How does that sort of crisis hunt for help raise the possibility of having to settle for a situation that is less than ideal?
A lot. You know, and I think what you're pointing out is an incredibly important aspect of aging, which is that we often don't think about it until there is a crisis. And so a lot of our response, both in our families, sometimes in our personal lives, and also as a policy matter, is crisis driven, as opposed to saying, how do we best get out ahead of it and plan for aging in constructive ways so that we're not searching for caregivers in a crisis. So we're not trying to figure out what is an older person's preference in a crisis, so that we figure out what's affordable to a particular family. Because one of the things that a lot of people, that comes as a surprise to a lot of people, is that long-term care is not covered by Medicare and often not covered by private health insurance. And so people are pretty much on their own in terms of paying for it. And Medicaid ends up being sometimes the payer of last resort there.
Would it be functionally impossible to pay for long-term care through government-funded programs?
You know, we spend an awful lot of money right now on long-term care, hundreds of billions, and not just the hundreds of billions that we discussed in terms of informal care, but also nursing homes and continuing care retirement communities together get more than $100 billion in taxpayer money a year. And we don't really know how that money's being spent and how much of it reaches the residents for whom it's intended. Sometimes we don't even know who owns the places that are providing the care. So I think we can't answer that question yet until we know how we're spending a lot of the money, or the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that we're already allocating to elder care. You know, another example is that, as you implied, a lot of it is crisis driven. And that is true in the healthcare setting too, so that, you know, it's acute care and it's devices and drugs and procedures, as opposed to preventive care, where we know we can do a lot and we can reduce costs. And by providing better, A, preventive care, and B, social services, I think we could save a lot of money. So we haven't even done the right kind of math there, I think. And we need to figure out where the money is being misspent and then reallocated to ways that improve the lives of older Americans and of caregivers much better.
Here's something I will confess I knew nothing about. You write about the fact that many nursing homes end up spending money and also making money by setting up these subsidiary suppliers. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, that, you know, that they go by the name related parties or other kinds of names. And essentially what it is you have a big corporate family that has lots of different branches. And so if you're making deals between different branches of the family, whatever is being bought and sold isn't necessarily being bought and sold for fair market value. And so you can inflate the prices, and that's one way that money leaves the system. The Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care, which is a leading advocacy group that represents consumers of long-term care, has done some analysis of this and has a report on its website that goes into much greater depth than I just have, but that's the basic notion.
When trying to determine the quality of, say, a nursing home facility, you say the ratio of staffers to residents is typically the most important factor in nursing home quality. Is there a good or ideal ratio?
That is a matter that is under discussion right now, and there are lots of varying opinions, and it depends on acuity, but there are basic, at some point, even Florence Nightingale, you know, working as fast as she can't take care of as many residents as many staff are expected to take care of. It's not just the number of staff, but it's also how staff are treated, because it's work that we don't value very highly. And that's reflected in how staff are paid and treated and supervised, and whether they have a sense of purpose in the work, because, you know, we don't value the people that they're caring for often, and we don't value the work of the caregivers. And so I think it's a many-pronged it's a many-pronged approach in terms of improving staffing. And I'm hoping that there are going to be staffing guidelines that come out of the Biden administration in the near future, as well as, you know, greater requirements for accountability for how public dollars are being spent.
I mean, we've done this with daycare centers. It seems obvious that we should be able to find some kind of rough estimate for nursing facilities and long-term care facilities.
Yeah, it's not rocket science. It's political will, I think. You know, we need to have the political will to really change how we provide long-term care. I mean, another thing that comes as a surprise to a lot of people is that nursing homes are a mandatory benefit, whereas what are called home and community-based services are optional. And so what we've done in some ways is replicated some of the issues that we had in the mental health system, which is that we had, you know, these big state hospitals, but never we cleaned them out. I mean, a lot of them were closed, but we never really created a community mental health system, which is what basically most experts agree is what we need. And a lot of that's true in aging, too. We need a robust system of aging supports and services, long-term supports and services in the community to help people stay at home when they can, and if not, to have a long-term care system that people feel like they can trust. Because it's a terrible position to put older people and families in if they feel like they can't trust or afford the options that they have available to them for care. And so they end up shouldering a huge burden, which is, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write about this is to say, look, it could be better. And we see you, caregivers, and that you deserve much more attention and help than you're getting.
Yeah, in some ways, it's not surprising people put off thinking about this because there is no obvious solution, especially if you have a loved one who, for issues of, say, cognitive decline, will require what amounts to 24-hour care.
Well, yes and no. You know, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit or medium-hanging fruit here. I mean, we know that caregivers need more support. And California has, I believe it's 11 caregiver resource centers that are really trying to provide more support and also collect data about what is actually helpful or most helpful to the caregivers. You know, having respite care or having somebody to help them figure out the financial issues. You know, there are ways that we know how to help caregivers in part. And so we should be doing much more of that. We also know that having good geriatric care really helps and promotes the health of older people and allows older people to be healthier and stay independent longer. And we don't have sufficiently compelling incentives for people to go into geriatrics. And so, like, last year, only half of the geriatric fellowship positions were filled. Those are things we can do something about. You know, and it's not really rocket science.
So why are there not incentives to go into geriatrics? Is it a problem of, you know, providing good care takes more time than can be reimbursed by existing insurance structures?
I think it's partially how we reimburse it, and that, you know, our inclination is to reimburse other kinds of interventions. But it's also, I think it goes back to the ageism too, which is that we have, you know, we don't value the work very highly. Although geriatricians have among the highest job satisfaction of any specialty in medicine, it's not a high status kind of specialty in the way that a lot of that stuff is measured in medicine. So, you know, that's another example, I think, of how our ageism seeps into the systems, so that we devalue geriatrics, we devalue caregiving, we don't have the kinds of systems to provide people the support they need. And here, I think, you know, one of the other traps, I think, is that we think of aging as relating to older people. But in fact, our policy failures relating to aging cascade through the generations. They affect caregivers. I know a lot of young people who are really worried about their parents who are the caregivers and are really struggling to be good caregivers. So it's so I think we're also sort of cordoning it off as this is just an aging issue, when in fact it's how we age is an issue for the whole life cycle.
MT, why does it matter what the reason is that somebody might need intensive help in terms of what kind of federal reimbursement their care might be eligible for? Like recovering from cancer or surgery, typically you get a paid stint in a rehab center. If you have advanced dementia, you're on your own?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, it's a kind of inequity that we haven't really addressed. And there's 6 million people with dementia. Now, not all of them need 24-hour care, but that's a real disparity that we have not addressed. It's the difference in how we reimburse acute versus chronic care. And, you know, it goes back to, I think, prevention and social services. You know, there's some suggestion by scholars of these things, of such matters, that societies that spend less on social services end up spending more on health services. And, you know, it makes a certain amount of intuitive sense if you think about how we've structured our aging, which is that, you know, we heroicize these great interventions, you know, for somebody who's 90, as opposed to thinking about how do we provide adequate care for everybody, for the families throughout life.
What options make it possible for more people to stay home, age in place, but still receive help where they need it?
A more robust system of what's sometimes called long-term services and supports, or home and community-based services, and helping caregivers better. And so that it isn't such an onerous job, but then also to have many more community supports. You know, one of the things that really struck me as I was writing the book is that there are actually a decent number of options, but even really educated people with a lot of resources find that it's incredibly complicated to navigate all the different options but in aging. You know, one of the things that really struck me is one of the people I write about is a geriatrician in Los Angeles, and she had a patient who she saw over a long period of time, and the daughter brought her mother to the appointments. The mother had dementia and some physical disabilities, and at some point the daughter handed the doctor a note that said, "Help me, I am overwhelmed." And so we're not seeing that. And it took the doctor, whose name is Laura Mosqueda, by surprise. And she said, "I had totally missed the amount of duress that the daughter was under." And I came to think of that as sort of a cry for help. And part of it is that navigating of the many different options. And so when I was writing this book, I was thinking, okay, so I was trying to put myself into the position of that daughter and millions of people like her who don't have a decent map of the terrain as they set out on this journey of aging, either themselves or helping somebody they love. And, you know, how do you figure out the care, and what are the senior centers, and what are the different medical specialties that might be particularly able to help us navigate these issues that are more, bring a more holistic approach? And what are the financial issues, and what are the autonomy safety issues? And, you know, it's not like there's any one silver bullet, but people need much better information to navigate navigate the challenges, because they're formidable, but also they need better information to navigate the high, I think, potential rewards of aging, which we also underestimate.
I do want to make sure that we talk about meaning, because it's really easy to get caught up in all the practicalities of providing elder care, of paying for elder care, of preventing elder abuse. We're also talking about human beings here. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned about the need for a sense of purpose at the end of life?
I'd love to. And this for me was both the most surprising aspect of my research and also by far the most hopeful. And it really changed how I live my life. So I'm really excited about this. I think because of our fear of old age, often we underestimate its potential as this time of more expansive thinking, of creativity, of exploration, and of inviting in all kinds of different types of awe, you know, travel or beauty or connection. And here one of the things that surprised me was it's not just feel good stuff, which is really a big deal in and of itself, but it also has very meaningful kinds of impact on health. There's a guy named Steve Cole at the University of California in Los Angeles, who's done some research looking at the benefits of volunteering. So having a sense of purpose and of doing something good and important for somebody else. So he looked at people who were volunteering with kids who were at risk. And it really helped the health of the older people who were doing the volunteering, not just in the short term, but over time. The equivalent of getting enough sleep or exercise or diet. So I think we underestimate the importance of thinking about our later years as an opportunity, in a way, because we've given up on them. But in fact, a lot of people retire in their 60s and often have another 20 years of life, maybe 30 years of life. And so what you want to do with that time is an incredibly important question and opportunity to think about what you can do for others and also what you want to do for yourself in terms of, you know, finding meaning in the time that you have.
Yeah, I really appreciated this aspect of the book, because it's easy to get hung up on the stuff that is just about survival, and that is incredibly important, and we want people to have sort of, you know, dignity and safety. But there's more to life than that. There's more to life than that when we're younger. There's no reason to believe there's not more to life than that when we're older.
Exactly right. I end up talking to a lot of people about navigating old age, either their own or with other people. And it seems so obvious, but to say the time is the sacred thing here. You have time alive with people you love. So just sometimes put all the other stuff out of your head, all the complicated, like, how do you navigate this and that, which is, you know, it's formidable, but what's sacred is time, and time ourselves and time with other people who we care about. And so just to focus on being together, and to asking questions and listening more carefully. You know, after my dad died, there were so many things I wanted to ask him, and it was too late. And, you know, to really consider how we want to be with the people we care about in this last chapter, and how we ourselves want to spend that last chapter and be remembered. So it's another reason, I think, to going back to the policy choices, why we need to really help people more than we do, so that they are less encumbered, and that there's less suffering, because there is a lot of low-hanging fruit here, I think. Even just helping people remember and realize the importance of, say, connection and purpose, and creating better cultural norms around those values, I think would be an enormously important thing. And my colleague, Mark Friedman, he says that the old and young were built for one another, and there's so much need and so much capacity, and that if we could harness the need in a more productive way, I think there's an awful lot of good we can do too.
I want to go back to this tension between autonomy, either ours or our loved ones, as we get older, and safety. The classic question for a lot of families is about driving. This is certainly something that families need to navigate internally, but I wonder if public policy could help with this.
Yes, absolutely. And again, it's not with silver bullets, but with approaches. So there's a wonderful saying that we want safety for the people we love, but autonomy for ourselves. And if we can keep that in mind when we're trying to navigate this sometimes rocky terrain, that alone is helpful. And what we know from some relatively old research is that if we trample people's autonomy rights, if we say, oh, we're going to make you safe and put you in a nursing home or something like that, often that actually makes them less safe. And it can lead to very sudden declines in health. And so sometimes what we think of as helping people be more safe actually is not. Similar kinds of questions come up with spending money. Say you have a new best friend or a new romantic interest, and that person suddenly wants a lot of money from you. Sometimes that really makes the older person happy, the thought of getting the attention, giving away the money. One victim advocate told me that for many people who she knows and works with who are scammed, the scammer was the only person calling the older adult on a regular basis. And so I think we need to, going back to your question, understand the roles of isolation and loneliness, how that makes us more vulnerable. And so staying connected helps, I think, immunize us. Also having purpose. A lot of times, like, for example, the saxophonist Kenny G's father fell into a scam, basically because he had a sense of being involved in an exciting business venture. He got a computer and a phone and all that. And so I think if we focus more on helping people have purposeful ways to spend time and stay connected with others, that's one part of it. But we also need ethicists and philosophers, I think, to help us navigate some of these issues and to provide much clearer guidance for family members and for policymakers. Because oftentimes what we end up doing is swinging wildly from one end to the other. So, for example, swinging from, we're going to protect everybody and put them in nursing homes, to, well, you have a right to give away all your money, you know, and now it's gone, and best of luck to you. There has to be a middle ground there, and we're not doing a great job often finding it. And people just need more guidance about how to navigate. And these were some of the most amazing stories for me, and, you know, I tried to capture them in the book about, you know, again, the doctor that I wrote about going out with Adult Protective Services, which is the entity that people call when an older adult is in trouble, and seeing people living in a really precarious way, you know, that without electricity or heat and under hoarding situations. And yet that's where they wanted to stay. They didn't want to be moved. And so those are really complicated questions that we need to do a lot better job with.
What is Medicaid planning, and what do people need to understand broadly about how that works?
Well, this goes back to your former question about that we cover some kinds of illnesses, for example, you know, more acute care if you fall and break your hip or something, versus Alzheimer's, where if you need help or supervision or somebody with you to make sure that, you know, you're not leaving on the gas or something, that is not reimbursed. And so Medicaid planning is a practice, is one name given for a practice of essentially spending down assets. So when a person is only eligible for Medicaid once they're impoverished, essentially, and there are different standards in different states, but you have to be poor to be eligible for Medicaid. And so sometimes what happens is that families or older adults will move their assets intentionally to become eligible for Medicaid. And sometimes it's because they're not, because they have an illness that isn't covered and don't want to wipe out the generational wealth in the family. And sometimes it's because they're getting pressure to do it by someone who actually just wants to take their money and doesn't, you know, doesn't want to have their money used on care. So there can be a whole range of reasons for the practice. But what people need to understand going into it is that to be poor and to be dependent on Medicaid means that you have fewer options and that you might not be able to hire or a caregiver because, or you might not be able to find a caregiver at the rates that Medicaid covers. And Medicaid actually has huge waiting lists. About, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are on waiting lists waiting for home and community-based services. So you may have no option but to go into a nursing home if you need around-the-clock care, if you can't find a caregiver. So it's really important to think carefully, and for people who encourage it or for people who are working with older people on Medicaid planning, to be very clear about what the potential risks are.
You note that guardianship, legal guardianship, is supposed to be a last resort. Why does it happen that laws in different places sometimes make it easier to seek full guardianship of an elder than more limited authority over certain aspects of their lives?
Such a great and important question. I mean, it might be worth just stepping back for a second, saying that when an older person or anybody is deemed unable to make decisions for themselves, there are a few different options. And guardianship requires going to court and getting a judge to say this person is incapacitated and needs to have somebody else make decisions for them, which is a pretty onerous process. More complicated often to have a limited guardianship, because then you have to start making decisions about more nuanced kinds of choices, because just because someone has a cognitive incapacity doesn't mean that they don't know what they want or can't make choices for themselves, which is a really important thing to keep in mind. You might not be able to do really complex financial transactions anymore, but you probably know where you want to live, who you want to live with, who you care about, who you love. And so it's really important to respect the rights that people have and not eliminate them wholesale. But there are also other problems with the guardianship system. And it, as you implied, it varies a lot from state to state because it's a creature of state law. And so every state has its own guardianship system. But we also don't really keep track very well of what guardians are doing. We don't know how many people are under guardianship. We don't monitor often. We often don't monitor guardians or require accountings of how they're spending the money, or even simple things like, did the person under guardianship get the glasses they need or go to the doctor, or do they get to see the people that they care about most, or you know, are they living the life they want to live? Do they have the kinds of activities in their lives? And are they just getting help with the things they specifically need help with? So we have an awful long way to go with guardianship. And going back to the bigger theme, it's another example, I think, of a social system where we have not done as well as we need to do, in part because we don't consider the issues of aging very well.
M.T. Connolly was founding head of the Department of Justice's Elder Justice Initiative, the architect of the Elder Justice Act, and a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. Her book is called The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. M.T., thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to the podcast everywhere you can find podcasts or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.